Made sure to start the recording. I'm from Chicago, so I made pizza as God intended. It was about that thick.
You can write that down.
Okay. Just to reorient us to where we were in the book of Jonah, I do not think you can read this book without remembering the historical situation that we found ourselves in, right? We read in 2 Kings that Jonah is prophesying during the reign of a specific Jeroboam. We know from various archaeological findings that that reign happened between 786 and 746, which means Jonah goes to Nineveh somewhere in that window. This is Grace Bible Church. You've read the book a million times. You've watched the VeggieTales with your kids. You know that Nineveh is going to repent. At the time, Assyria was going through a series of famines, inner unrest and turmoil. It appeared as though divine justice was being enacted against essentially what was a terrorist state. Remember, the Assyrians are not good people at all. It looked like God was finally visiting them with justice. And not only did they have this inner turmoil, they were being attacked on their northern flank from the Urartu Empire, which is what drew them away from a military campaign against Israel to begin with. Now Jonah's going to show up in Nineveh. They're going to repent. God is going to forgive them. Sennacherib is going to make Nineveh the capital of Assyria. And within 20 years of the death of Jeroboam, Assyria is going to launch an invasion of Israel and completely annihilate the 10 tribes. To the point that we literally call them Jews because the kingdom of Judah is the only one that remains. That is the stake that Jonah, or those are the stakes that Jonah is dealing with. Okay, he knows, he can read the writing on the wall, he knows that Assyria is coming, it's just a matter of when. And so when God says, hey, I want you to go to Assyria, I want you to preach repentance because their Gadol Ra'ah, their great evil, has come up before me, I've noticed it, Jonah says, nah, I'm good, and flees the other way. And remember, we talked about Jonah's flight from God being physical and spiritual. God says, travel by land. He goes by sea. God says, go to Nineveh. He says, no, I'm going to go to Tarshish. And then we have this repeated word that continues to show up in chapter 1. Yarad. He went down to the port of Joppa. He went down to the boat on the dock. He went down to the cargo hold and fell asleep. And you know where this story is going. God's going to show up and say, all right, let's go all the way down. If this is really how you want to run, let's see where this goes. So we find ourselves in the midst of a storm in chapter 1. We find ourselves on a boat with a bunch of Gentile sailors who are terrified of this storm. They think that they are going to die. They are so concerned about the weight of this storm that they're throwing the cargo over the edge of the ship. Remember, that means they're not going to get paid. They think that they are going to die, and the only way to survive is to lighten that boat up so they can survive the storm. And so they are literally throwing their livelihoods overboard in an attempt to save their physical lives. That's where we pick up the story, okay? So I'm going to read verse 6. Actually, I'm going to read verse 5 again. The sailors were so afraid that each cried out to his own God and flung the ship's cargo overboard in an attempt to make the ship lighter. Jonah, meanwhile, had gone down into the hold below, had lain down and was fast asleep. I started to pitch this idea to you last week. I'm going to hammer on it today. One of the only ways to sleep in a storm is if you are content in your decision making. I think Jonah is so convinced that he is in the right that he's able to sleep in the middle of a hurricane. I'll continue to pitch that as chapter 1 unfolds. The ship's captain approached and said, what are you doing asleep? Get up, cry out. The exact same words that God uses earlier in chapter 1. call out to your God, for perhaps your God might take notice of us that we might not die. And so the sailors said to one another, come on, let's cast lots. Let's find out whose fault it is that this, in the word being used here is ra'ah, that this ra'ah has overtaken us. Remember, the word is going to be used to mean several things in the Hebrew language. The primary one is the wickedness that we do to each other, the actual interpersonal evil that we commit against one another. However, in a series of divine interactions with the physical world, Hebrew authors will also call things like storms and famines, some sort of calamity or disaster, some sort of evil that God is sending on the earth in response to the evil that the earth is committing. Everybody with me? So the word being used here is the same. The Ra'ah of Nineveh has gone up before God. God has sent a Ra'ah down, and the sailors view it as Ra'ah. They view it as disaster, as evil. So they said, they cast lots, and Jonah was singled out, and they said to Jonah, tell us, whose fault is it that this disaster has overtaken us? What's your occupation? Where do you come from? What's your country? Who are your people? And I love that kind of rapid-fire series of questions, right? These guys are panicked. The lot fell to Jonah. They're trying to save their lives. What did you do? Seems to be the point of these questions. Who are you? Who are you running from? What are you doing? Jonah said, I am a Hebrew. And I fear, or some of your translations might have the word worship. I fear the God of Israel, Yahweh, the Lord, who made the sea and the dry land. Now, this is another word that I'm going to have to highlight. The word is Yarah. Chuck, did I get that right? Yarah, to fear?
Yep.
Okay. Are you reading in the Hebrew over there?
Yeah.
Oh, this is perfect. For those of you that don't know, Chuck is fluent in like 11 languages that no longer exist and a couple that are still used. we're going to do some work in cuneiform today, Chuck. Here, are you fluent in that?
I'm here for it.
Let's go. This is a word that I want to pause and unpack for a minute. Yarah literally means to fear, but it's also used for worship. It is the same word. That there is a relationship between fear and worship that for the Hebrews, they were entangled with one another, right? Now, you know this. We'll say stuff like, the fear of the Lord is the start of wisdom and all these random things. In the moment in Jonah, though, I'm not talking about some sort of abstract Christianese stuff that I might put on my refrigerator. This is legitimate fear of a storm. And Jonah says, well, you know, I guess I fear Yahweh who made the sea and the dry land. What the author is inviting us to do is to contrast the types of fear. Is Jonah acting scared? No, he's sleeping. He's not scared at all. And yet he uses this word because the author is wanting us to contrast especially what the sailors are about to do with what Jonah has already done. And so again, that word, to fear, is the same word to worship. Verse 10, hearing this, the sailors became even more afraid. Gadol Yarah. And said to him, what have you done? And the men said this because they knew that he was trying to escape from the Lord, because he had previously told them. The storm was growing worse and worse, and they said to him, what should we do to you to make the sea calm down for us? Jonah said, pick me up, throw me into the sea, and it will make the sea quiet down, because I know it's my fault that you are in this severe storm. That's a bizarre solution to this problem, to say the least. Nowhere do we have any sort of inkling in other biblical stories that Jonah would think, hey, if they just throw me overboard, God's going to forgive them, right? Like, if this was an issue of some kind of repentance, all Jonah would have to do is ask for forgiveness, actually approach God in a repentant manner. He seems to be after something else, and I want you to put a bookmark in chapter 1. We're going to go to chapter 4 so I can build this case a little bit more compellingly, because I like to jump around in Jonah. Chapter 4, we see Jonah's actual motivation, and we see him say something to God that I think is important for our understanding of what he's trying to do in chapter 1. Chapter 4, God has already forgiven Nineveh. Verse 1, I don't know what your translation says, but it should read, this pissed Jonah off. He became very angry. And he prayed to the Lord. And by the way, he's angry because God has forgiven people that are unforgivable. He prayed to the Lord and said, oh Lord, this is just what I thought would happen when I was in my own country. This is what I tried to prevent by attempting to escape to Tarshish. I wanted to escape because I knew if I escaped, you would not forgive them. I was trying to prevent you from forgiving them. I know that you're a big old softy. You're gracious, you're compassionate, you're slow to anger, you're abounding in mercy, you're one who relents concerning threat and judgment. I know that it's in your character to forgive those who do not deserve forgiveness. I know that. That's why I ran. And then he says this, verse 3, kill me instead, for I would rather die than live. Back in chapter 1, what is Jonah trying to accomplish by saying, throw me overboard? He's trying to commit suicide. And I think this is a point we cannot miss. Do not approach the text and say to yourself, well, Jonah knew that God was going to calm the storm of blah, blah, blah. Jonah knew that God was going to provide a fish. No, he didn't. We have it from Jonah's mouth in chapter 4. I would rather be dead than live in a world in which the Assyrians are forgiven. I would rather die than live. And that's what we see in chapter 1. I would rather die because if I die, God's message of forgiveness dies with me. That's how passionate he is about his mission. And that's how convinced he is that he's right and God is wrong. That he is going to force God's hand. That he is going to illuminate for God the kind of mistake that God seems to be making in Jonah's eyes. So let's see what the sailors do back in chapter 1. Verse 13. Instead, they tried to row back to land, but they were not able to do so because the storm kept growing worse and worse. And they cried out to the Lord, please, Lord, do not let us die on the account of this man. Do not hold us guilty for shedding innocent blood. After all, you, Lord, have done just as you pleased. And so they picked Jonah up. They threw him into the sea. The sea stopped raging. Verse 16, and the men had a gadol yarah for Yahweh, and they earnestly vowed to offer lavish sacrifices to the Lord. It is smart to be scared of a storm that can kill you. It is wise to be terrified of the one who controls it. We see the exact same scene play out at the end of Mark chapter 4. A bunch of fishermen are in a boat. A storm comes on the Sea of Galilee. Professional fishermen are scared they're going to die. A guy whose name starts with J decided to pull a pillow out and went to sleep. They wake him up and they say, oh, don't you care if we're going to die? He looks at them and says, you idiots, do you really think you're going to drown while I'm here? And he stands up and looks at the storm and says, peace be still. And what is the disciples' reaction? Are they thankful? Are they elated? What is their reaction? They are terrified. Because again, smart to be afraid of a storm that can kill you. Wise to be terrified of the one who controls it. Now we can have a full comparison between these Gentile sailors who don't even get names and Jonah. Jonah says he fears, he yaraz, Yahweh, the God of Israel. And yet the sailors are the ones who seem to be responding in the correct way. The sailors are the one who says, you know what? I'm going to make a vow to Yahweh here. When I get back to port, I'm going to make a sacrifice. I'm going to reorient my life around this God, not the God that I was praying to 5 minutes ago, because this God truly does control the sea and the land. I am going to do what this God asks me to do. Jonah, on the other hand, is the guy who thinks he knows better than God. Remember, the actions of Jonah in chapter 1 are not the actions of a man who's afraid. That's what we see out of the sailors. They're scared. The actions of Jonah in chapter 1 are actions of supreme confidence. He thinks he's right. He thinks God's wrong. And we're going to see that play out over the remainder of the course of the book. So we've got one more verse in this pericope. Some of your translations are going to have this as chapter 2, verse 1. Some of your translations are going to have this as chapter 1, verse 17. Regardless, this is kind of the pinnacle of the theological movement of chapter 1. So the Lord, do you have the word appointed? Do you have the word since? Yeah. Okay. This is the word manah or minah. It means to appoint. We're going to see God manah several things as the progression of the text or as the text progresses. Am I right about this or does he not use manah until chapter 4? Why do I ask him? Let the record show Chuck made a Muppet joke. Yeah. Okay. Done. Fiend. Okay. Hey, this is the word that's going to be used in chapter 4 when God is appointing a plant and God is appointing a worm and things like that. What the text wants us to do is compare the response of the things that God appoints to a specific task to how Jonah responds to his appointment to a specific task. The word is typically used of a prophet, a king, or a judge. In other words, somebody who has an important role to play in the divine will as the sovereign plan of God is unfolding. He is going to appoint important people to do important things. Jonah has been appointed to do an important thing. It goes the opposite direction. And the text is going to say, hey, we're not just going to compare Jonah to a bunch of Gentile sailors. We're also going to compare him to a fish and a plant and a worm and a wind and all these other things that God orchestrates. By the way, the fish doesn't run in the opposite direction. The plant doesn't pause to have a theological argument with God. And the worm certainly does not tell God he's wrong and I'm right. So God appoints, he sends a great fish to swallow Jonah. And Jonah was in the stomach of the fish for 3 days and three nights. A great fish. One of the more interesting consequences of the recent war in Iraq was that Western archaeologists for the first time in decades had access to ancient sites that were in Israel, or I'm sorry, in Iraq. Western archaeologists were able to go into some of those tells and they were able to excavate and they were able to study because the country wasn't closed off anymore because it was invaded and at war. Across the Tigris River from Mosul, Iraq, which was in the news for years and years and years, is the site of ancient Nineveh. And as Western archaeologists began excavating it and learning more about the Assyrian language and learning more about how the Assyrians understood the city of Nineveh, they discovered that in cuneiform, Nineveh, and hey, correct me if I get any of this wrong, was noted like this, and I cannot draw, so forgive me. Nineveh was the centralized place of worship for the fish god Dagon because of its primary place on the Tigris River. Seems that the industry of the majority of the city was based on fishing and based on selling that fish within the region. The cuneiform literally was a house or a place of the fish. Nineveh literally means place of the fish. God says, I want you to go to the place of the fish. Jonah says, I'm going to go the opposite direction. God says, okay. you're going to wind up exactly where I told you you were going. It's one of the only compliments I can give the VeggieTales iteration of Jonah. Do you remember in that story? They're slapping each other with fish. Yeah. VeggieTales got one thing right. I'm just kidding. VeggieTales is great. Okay. This seems to be God's theological MO. I'm going to orchestrate things in such a way that I get your attention so that you know I'm trying to get your attention. I want you to go to the place of the great fish. Jonah says, no, I'm going to go the opposite direction. God puts him in the place of the great fish. And then you know where chapter 2 is going. We're going to go all the way down. If you want to see how far you can run from me, I'm going to take you all the way down. Of course, we know this. What does the psalmist say? If I make my bed in the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths of Sheol, as far down as you can go, you're still there. And Jonah and God are going to have a conversation at the very bottom of the ocean in chapter 2. But God seems to have something different in mind for Jonah, to orchestrate things in such a way that it is unmistakably God trying to get his attention. Now look, if I take the story literally, and I'm Jonah, and I get swallowed by a gigantic fish, I think I'm going to pay attention to whatever happens inside that fish, yes? But the significance of God saying, I want you to go here, Jonah goes here and winds up exactly where God told him he was going to go. That cannot be missed. And again, this is God's MO. You remember Jacob? Yaakov, grabber of the heel because of how he was born with his twin brother Esau. You remember the story? It's a delightful story about a happy family in which one son deceives his blind father by dressing up in goat fur because mom told him to. This is an incredibly destructive family, right? He steals the birthright. He steals the blessing. Esau tries to kill him. He runs away. Esau changes the meaning of Jacob from grabber of the heel to deceiver. Yes? Yeah. So the word Jacob literally means deceiver. Jacob goes to hide at Uncle Laban's house. You remember he meets a girl named Rachel, falls head over heels in love with her. Laban says, if you work for me for 7 years, you can marry her. The text says something fascinating in Genesis. It says the 7 years passed as a day because Jacob was so in love, so romantic. And then on his wedding night, probably has too much to drink, wakes up the next morning, slept with the wrong woman. And Uncle Laban looks at Jacob and says something fascinating. When Jacob says, how could you possibly deceive me? How could you, Jacob, Jacob? Laban says, is it not our custom to take care of the elder before we take care of the younger? And in a moment, Jacob realizes for the first time in his life what he did to Esau. He has to work another 7 years, right? Because now he's married Leah. He's also going to marry Rachel. He has to work another 7 years. The text does not say that it passed quickly. And we're supposed to infer that those 7 years were a long 7 years of reflection. As soon as he marries the right woman, packs up his whole family to go home. Because he's a brave man, he sends his whole family ahead of him across the Jordan. When he hears that Esau's riding out with 300 men, not for a friendly, brotherly chat. And it's only after the deceiver has been deceived in the same way that he once deceived somebody else, that's when God shows up to wrestle. Now that I've got your attention, we got to work a few things out. And it's a beautiful story. They wrestle through the night. In the morning, God touches his hip and dislocates it. However we want to understand that WWE wrestling style, coming off the top ropes, whatever. And God renames him Yisrael, the one who wrestles with God. And for the first time, we see a man who was known by his sin, who will forever be known by his relationship with God. It's a beautiful, small illustration of the gospel. But for my purposes, what I want you to see is this is how God operates. If I'm trying to get your attention, if I'm God trying to get your attention, I will orchestrate things so that you have no other choice but to acknowledge me, but to recognize me so that we can deal with whatever it is that we're dealing with. I told you to go to the place of the great fish. You don't want to go. Well, guess what? You're going to wind up exactly where I told you you were going to wind up. And not only that, I'm going to take you exactly where you want to go, all the way down. Magnificent. Magnificent. I'm also going to say this. I mentioned this last week. The literal nature of the fish is literally and figuratively the shallowest question we can ask at this point. And commentators are in wide disagreement on whether or not an actual fish swallowed Jonah, or if this is some kind of metaphorical way to describe what Jonah is going through. I'm not going to comment one way or the other because I don't think it damages the integrity of the story. The story is about a man who's convinced he's right and that God's wrong. And the story is about a God who orchestrates things so that he can look at this man and say, hey, I'm a God who forgives the unforgivable, and you've got to figure this out. Okay? Everybody with me on that? For further questions, my email is jcloud@gracebiblechurch.org. Here's what I want to discuss today, and forgive me for not pushing us to discussion last week. I want to focus on this. Yara, to fear. Same word in Hebrew for worship. To what role should fear play in my worship of God? Right, and look, obviously at some level, I am incapable of worshiping something unless it is above me in some way. Everybody with me? Okay, so I am incapable of worshiping something that I am equal with. In order for me to bow, in order for me to worship, that thing has to be above me. And yet, the Hebrews seem to suggest that there is an emotional connection with this word and worship. And my question to you is how great should the role of fear play in that worship? Because we're going to go inside in a few minutes, and I'm going to sing some Chris Tomlin song or whatever, and I'm pretty sure I'm not going to be scared. Everybody with me? All right. To what extent, to what role should fear play in my worship of God? You.